far.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America has a long history of political protest, but in the digital age, dissenters are brandishing their placards on their websites. No group has embraced the web's broad and instant reach better than anti-abortion activists. Their websites not only list doctors' names and addresses, but post personal details and photographs of women entering abortion clinics. The American justice system has only begun to address the legal questions that such websites provoke. Do they violate women's privacy? Or don't privacy issues matter since the photographs are taken in public spaces? Are their websites protected by the First Amendment? Or is free speech gone too far? This hour, abortion and the Internet, the battle between free speech and privacy. We begin tonight with a look at what's on the anti-abortion websites and how it gets there. Earlier, I spoke with Neil Horsley. He manages abortioncams.com, a website that posts photos of women entering abortion clinics. He claims that the site gets almost 2 million hits a month. I asked him to explain and justify what's on his website.
Well, we tell the complete story of legalized abortion. We have articles that talk about legalized abortion as well as an ongoing and updated pictorial record of the events that are occurring around many abortion clinics in the United States.
Now, you say pictorial record. You mean photographs of people who are going into these clinics. Is that right?
People who are going in, people who are going by, people who are standing outside protesting, the entire gamut of people who are involved in the environment around the abortion clinic.
And why are you doing this?
Well, because it's a riveting story that has generated a huge audience, and it has the ability to deter people from killing little babies.
That the people will be afraid to go into these abortion clinics, and therefore they won't get abortions? Is that what you're saying?
I think that what's actually going on is shame. Shame that they're being exposed for doing a horrible and shameful deed to their own child.
And that this deed is constitutionally protected, that doesn't matter to you?
Well, it certainly doesn't. A legalized slavery was constitutionally protected, but that made it nonetheless a heinous sin. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're protesting and demonstrating to the American people that even though the Constitution has been defined as allowing this horrible slaughter of God's children, that we know better.
How do you know better? What is your religious background?
Well, we've looked at the what comes out of the womb of these people, and we've seen with our own eyes that, in fact, they're little babies. And if the courts would allow us to bring the DNA testing evidence in that they allow in every other case of DNA identification, we could prove that they're individual human beings who are being butchered, literally ripped limb from limb.
An earlier website you ran, you may still run it, called the Nuremberg Files, carried the names and addresses of abortion providers, doctors, and clinics, and you crossed out the names of the doctors who were on that list when they were murdered. Aren't you sort of proposing a similar model here, that you're not afraid that in the minds of some people you might be targeting these women going in for abortions?
We're not targeting anybody. What we're doing is reporting a matter of serious public concern that's occurring in a public place.
Now, you have college-age children. How would you feel if some fanatic circulated their photos and whereabouts to other such souls all over the country? What would you think about that?
Well, if it would prevent them from becoming murderers, I would thank God for it.
But you're a parent. What would you think of just having your children on the web like that? Wouldn't that bother you? Wouldn't you be afraid that some fanatic somewhere might conceive an obsession to harm them?
No, that would not. What would be a greater concern was that they would not be deterred from becoming murderers themselves. there are some things worse than being killed, and in my mind, my own children, murdering my grandchildren is one of those things. The fact is, people who have been published on my website have never been harmed after having been published on my website, and this has been going on for 3 years. But for 3 years, hysterical people like yourself have been making the same empty accusations. The fact is, it hasn't happened. It's only because what you're trying to do is destroy my constitutional rights.
Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that your Nuremberg files was amounted, quote, to a true threat.
Now, what they said was my Nuremberg files was constitutionally protected speech.
Well, I'm looking at the Ninth Circuit judgment in the Wall Street Journal article, which says that the court said that doctors had begun wearing bulletproof vests as a result of the posters and website, and concluded that the protesters' activities, quote, amounted to a true threat and not protected speech.
Well, if you read the last sentence of the Ninth Circuit opinion, it says the Nuremberg files is constitutionally protected speech.
Presumably, this judgment has gone against you in the Ninth Circuit. Are you now appealing this to the Supreme Court?
Oh, yes. That decision is under appeal.
So you concede that the decision went against your side and your what you do on this website?
If you go to the Internet, mm-hmm. and you pull up the Nuremberg files, you will see with your own eyes that, in fact, the website is still there. The only change we made because of the Ninth Circuit decision is we added the names of those six baby-butchering judges to the Nuremberg files list, and if you go look, you'll see their names printed there.
Are you also getting ready to put the names and addresses of the women you photograph available, make those available on the web?
We intend to publish all the facts that we can find about the events occurring around these places they call abortion clinics. That is our responsibility as journalists, and we intend to tell all the facts, bar none.
What about your own life? I mean, what would you feel like if someone with a camera followed you around and took photographs of things you did? Wouldn't you feel that was an invasion of your privacy, quite apart from the issue of what you were doing?
People do that already.
Who does that already?
I was on NBC News on Saturday. The fact of the matter is I am fully aware that when I project myself into a matter of serious national concern and accept responsibility for becoming a part of a national story that involves the meaning of the Constitution of the United States of America, that I am expected to be part of a public story. And I do not pretend to do anything other than that.
Neil Horsley is an anti-abortion activist. He spoke with us from Carrollton, Georgia. We're talking tonight about anti-abortion websites and the clash of rights in the digital age. Are all websites protected by the First Amendment? How would you feel about having your picture taken as you enter the doctor's office and having it shown on the Internet? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Professor Jonathan Zittrain. He's co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Also with us is tonight's On Point news analyst, Judith Kayham. She's a former Justice Department counsel for civil rights and is currently at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, both.
Hi there.
Did I promote you, Jonathan Zittrain?
Only as much as you should be.
I want to make you your co-director, and that's good enough for me.
Correct.
Okay. Jonathan, this is a I read the story, which is an amazing story, in last week's Wall Street Journal, bringing out all this, and I said, how can this be legal? How can it be legal to put photographs of women who are exercising their constitutional rights on a website that people all over the country can see, and in a context where violence has been used against abortion providers and possibly against people who even procure abortions? How can that possibly be legal?
Well, to be sure, it may turn out that it's not legal. This is something that hasn't yet worked its way through the legal system, and I think it may be a tougher case than the Nuremberg files case that's already gone up to the Ninth Circuit, as you were just talking about. It's clear from your interview with Neil Horsley, Central Casting couldn't offer a better example of the lone individual that is a full-time zealot. He's got his beliefs. They're unshakable. And before the internet, he may well have been restricted to handing out pamphlets at one clinic and kind of raising as much of a ruckus as he can, but truly a local phenomenon. And now it's clear he's got an ability to put up a website, get some publicity, generate lots and lots of hits, and cause that much more concern among women, maybe all across the country, who are wanting to get these services. Now, to your question as to whether or not it's legal, the problem is that Supreme Court doctrine around this has tended to focus on, is it a threat? And the answer to that question, at least if you look at just the pure kind of doctrine of it, has tended to require a really imminent threat. We're pretty much talking about somebody saying, I'm coming to kill you right now. Mm-hmm. And that finally is a threat. And it would require really a little bit of kind of tailoring of the doctrine to these circumstances if one wanted to follow this threat path to say that the First Amendment doesn't protect it. And that might it might be fruitful not to think of it as a threat. There might be other ways doctrinally to say this is illegal and the First Amendment doesn't protect it.
Well, he was talking as if he used words like publishing, the facts, the story. He was talking as if he were a journalist and he was publishing something. Well, he's not a journalist. This isn't journalism, is it? And should it have the privileges of journalism to be able to...
Well, the first concern certainly any judge is going to have wanting to draw a line, supposing, is to make sure that the line is firm enough so that journalists doing the core task of the press are not at all impeded by any decision that says taking these pictures is not legal. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, this is the sort of thing judges might do. They'll think hypothetically about citizens that stand in front of a crack house or a brothel and take pictures of people going in. Or a news organization does one of its investigative undercover stings and takes picture of people doing various activities. And wanting to draw those lines, I think, is where people get into, well, am I prepared to say exactly who's a journalist and who isn't? But I think those lines are the kinds of lines judges draw all the time. And they can look at the totality of the site, try to discern what its real purpose is. Here you have Neil Horsley saying outright that its primary purpose, it seems, is to deter the women from going into the clinics. It's certainly predictable it could cause any number of them great distress, and distress not just grounded in shame. And those are the sorts of things that, even under state law, what you call the common law, are often thought of as actionable. And then one just sees, all right, how close does it go before the First Amendment somehow curtails what the state can limit?
Julia, where do you draw the line here? Is this free speech or is this irresponsible pandering to hatred?
Somewhere in between. I mean, unfortunately, I think a lot of people, or fortunately, are sort of torn about this one, and maybe I'm consistent with the ACLU on this issue, which is they don't have a position right now. The politics of this are quite interesting, that you have an incident, you know, of course, an organization like the ACLU wants to promote free speech, and something like what Neil is doing, I think in any other context, would probably be supported by the ACLU. But then you have the difficult and historic issue that these websites are not innocuous. And if you haven't visited it, I do actually urge listeners to visit it. Picking up on what Professor Jonathan, I know him well, said was that, you know, you go on the website, it has a 50-state hit. I mean, this is, you know, you can look at your state, and I looked at Massachusetts, and there are women there that I know, and there. And so it's not this local guy standing on a corner. It has a much greater impact, and we know the history. You can't take this out of the context, which is that abortion doctors have been killed and violence has been done against them. So, you know, the politics of this are really tricky. It probably will come out somewhere similar to, I think, the buffer litigation. How close can protesters get to an abortion clinic? And actually, Congress legislated in this regard, creating the Freedom of Access to Clinics Act, which was enforced by the Department of Justice, which is people have a right to protest abortion, but there's going to be some restrictions on it. And I think, as Jonathan said, there it's going to be sort of where do you want to draw that line? Certainly, the rest of Neil's website seems to me totally to be free speech. I mean, you know, the rest of it in terms of abortion is bad and things like that.
Where he has his information.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, his website, as you say, how he can propagate this to millions, it reminds me of what someone said about Joseph Stalin, that he was Genghis Khan with a telephone.
Right.
And technology can ramify and increase the effects of even one person. And, of course, he isn't one person. He's part of a whole network. He has people who submit photographs to him from all over the country. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is W.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the collision between privacy and free speech, the issue presented by anti-abortion websites that broadcast pictures of women going into abortion clinics nation and indeed worldwide. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now on the line is Diane Luby, who is the president of the Massachusetts president of Planned Parenthood. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jack.
Now, has your picture shown up on one of these websites?
Unfortunately, it has.
And what was the circumstance?
The circumstance is what has been happening at Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts for about the past year is that people have been coming and photographing staff, physicians, people entering the clinic, just coming for visits, for meetings, and then sending these photographs on to Neil Horsley and his website.
Hmm. And there's your picture, no address.
License plate.
License plate. Hmm. Have you felt fear looking at those pictures?
I think there's some amount of fear that you feel daily, on a daily basis, when there are people protesting in front of Planned Parenthood. We do a lot with our staff. We do a lot with our patients. We work cooperatively with the police and law enforcement on how to mitigate kind of eruptions of violence when protesters are getting so close to our patients and so close to our staff. But this is really taking it to a different level of taking photographs and then publishing them on the website.
Do you know of any incident of violence or do you know of any woman who's been interfered with in exercise of her rights because of her picture having appeared on one of these websites?
I do not know of that at our clinic. What I do know is when some people are taking photographs and one of our patients is coming into the building and they may be with a partner or their husband or someone, that there have been occurrences of pushing and shoving and people getting really angry at that.
What do you say to, you perhaps heard the interview I did with Neil Horsley, who really says, I'm a journalist, I'm publishing the facts, it is a fact that Woman A went into Clinic B on such and such a day, and I'm just publishing that the way a newspaper would, and I'm exercising my free rights, my free speech. What do you say to that?
Well, I think everybody heard Neil Horsley, and it's kind of hard to believe that once you've heard him. If a person like Neil Horsley were really serious about working on this as a public health issue and focusing on the real problem here, which is unintended pregnancies, then I think it's far more constructive to do what Planned Parenthood does and really work on family planning, about sexuality education, on prevention. And 4.7 million women visit Planned Parenthood clinics every single year. That's a lot of photographs for him to be taking. It's also points out that this is not something that is going to stop because Neil Horsley is taking these photographs. We look forward to there being some case law on this because this really does seem to be harassment and intimidation of women trying to have some dignity and safety about getting health care services.
And is that one of the ways that Planned Parenthood is going to fight back through lawsuits?
Yes, we intend to, and I think that we're pretty careful about what goes on around our clinic. We want all of the women who are coming in to see us. One in four women in this country mm-hmm. will go to a Planned Parenthood organization.
Yes.
And we want them to come safely mm-hmm. and to have a good experience with a health care provider. Mm-hmm. Many of them are coming for education, for mm-hmm. family planning, mm-hmm. for other things. And I think you just have to listen to Neil Horsley to understand that he's an extremist.
Yes, and I should mention, and I'm making no connection to Mr. Horsley, I'm just, as he would, mentioning the fact that within a 10-minute walk of where we are right now, two women were murdered who were at an abortion clinic or at a public...
At our Planned Parenthood.
At your Planned Parenthood clinic in Brookline, not 5 or 10 years ago. So these things, there is this climate of hatred in the air. There's no question about it. Diane Luby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
Jack?
Yeah, Julie, go ahead.
I wanted to just pick up on what Diane began with, because there's a way to talk about this that can get us out of the difficult abortion context, which is we need to think about this. Is there, you know, anything in the law that enables the individual, someone like Diane, to stop this website, doesn't matter what kind of website, from putting her picture up? So let's just take it out of the abortion context. And then I think, so that's the first question, and you can imagine all sorts of causes of action, mm-hmm. intentional infliction of emotional distress, mm-hmm. a possible tort, whatever. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, Jerry Falwell used this, you know, against Playboy when they, I don't know if people remember this, Playboy mocked a sexual relationship with him and his mother, and he used intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, the second question is, does the First Amendment come in then as a defense, right? Can the journal, which like Playboy did mm-hmm. and eventually won, or Neil, come in and defend using the First Amendment? But those are two questions that have nothing to do with abortion. And it seems to me, you know, as Jonathan was pointing out, these cases turn out, they're going to have a broad impact on all sorts of internet mm-hmm. and publication that have nothing to do with this very contentious issue of abortion.
Mm-hmm. You see it that way, Jonathan?
Yes, there's certainly two layers at which the law is struggling to figure this stuff out. One is just to say what's legal and what's not as just a matter of, say, state law. And the second is whether on what the states can do. And to answer Juliet's question a little bit, what's striking to me is what the law has most well articulated as far as privacy goes is if you're walking on the street and somebody takes your picture and it ends up on a Wheaties box mm-hmm. as the Breakfast of Champions, you've got a cause of action because you mm-hmm. are due some piece of the money that's mm-hmm. being made because mm-hmm. you're selling cereal against your mm-hmm. own consent. Mm-hmm. And to see the law having articulated that so well, and no one seems to think there's a First Amendment issue at preventing General Mills from using your photo mm-hmm. without your permission. And then to see it in this gray zone where it's a much more emotionally fraught situation, it would be helpful to have the law catch up.
Of course, in this case, in the Nuremberg Files case, which was a case raising the issue of putting the photos and addresses of doctors.
Yes.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the West Coast found that there was, in fact, a true threat, that it wasn't just a generic sort of case of, you know, free speech versus privacy, that there was a true threat because because of the whole context of murdered doctors and so on. Is that logic transportable to the cases raised by abortioncam.com? Or do we have to have a situation right. where women are actually murdered?
Right. I think for those who would be litigating on the side of people that don't want their pictures taken and put up on the web, I would tend probably not to push the threat argument mm-hmm. so far, just mm-hmm. as a practical matter, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. trying to get the doctrine straight. Even in the Nuremberg Files case, it was these wanted posters that really produced the most judicial skepticism rather than the site itself. Yes, I think that's what mm-hmm. Neil Horsley mm-hmm. was getting at when he was talking to you before. But I don't think the threat is the only way you have to go. There really is, I think, at the intersection of threat and privacy and what Tort would just call antisocial behavior that we just don't accept and are prepared as a society to sanction. You can say we sanction it. That's what, mm-hmm. When Juliet mentions intentional infliction of emotional distress, mm-hmm. that's the kind of realm so-called IIED has in mind. And we can separate the act of taking the photo mm-hmm. as an act designed to make the person whose photo mm-hmm. is being taken feel terrible and,
yes.
you know, have nightmares, that kind of thing, from the act of publishing it as a journalist. And if we think most of that act is directed to the woman rather than to the public, it may even be easy to see a path where the First Amendment isn't as much of a bar to taking on the behavior that's actually causing the discomfort by the person who's having the picture taken.
Yeah, if this debate sounds familiar, it's similar to sort of the discussions last week that all political commentators and news analysts had about these FBI guidelines that we're now discussing about this issue of when does speech become threat and the loosening of the FBI guidelines when they can begin criminal prosecutions. And I'll tell you, I talked to a lot of my left Democratic friends who were thrilled by the prospect that the FBI would now have more leeway, generally, but because it has been generally the FBI guidelines historically had been a bar to investigating, not just Muslim charities, but also abortion groups and a white right-wing supremacist groups. And that had always been a bar for the FBI that you couldn't begin an investigation. Mm-hmm. As I said before, the politics of this are very interesting.
I had no idea of that connection. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jamie, I apologize for making you wait so long. Welcome.
Thank you. I initially had called to raise an issue that I think has been well covered by your guests around the balance between privacy, which is a constitutional right, and specifically the right to make an abortion decision privately has been found. But I don't think the threat issue should be totally lost from the population I'm involved with, which is teenagers who have sought judicial consent for abortion. And in the past, I've had clients say to me, back when they were protesting from the clinic and the news cameras were there, I'm afraid to go to the clinic. What if I'm on the news and my parents see me? And these are often young women who are afraid of harm or adverse consequences from their parents knowing that they're sexually active, that they're pregnant, they're seeking an abortion. For these young women, the cam does is a threat to them should their parents become aware of their activities. So while it may not be as much of a threat for an adult woman who may want her privacy but not fear being attacked by an anti-abortion fanatic, for some young women, they do fear actual consequences if their parents learned of their activities.
That's right, that they wouldn't be able to exercise their rights because their photograph had appeared.
Right.
That would prevent them from...
And the court, the Supreme Court, specifically set up this judicial bypass system to allow young women who fear the adverse consequences to be able to bypass their parents. That right would be lost if they're on the web.
And these adverse consequences can be what?
Being thrown out of the house, being physically beaten, being said, I've always said if you get in trouble, I'm not going to pay for you to go to college, being shunned, being forced into marriages. Young women who've said, who are from other countries, that if my parents find out that I'm pregnant, they'll send me back to the old country. A whole range of fears that they have, many of which are justified based on the experiences of other people in their families.
Well, you raise a very good question. What about this special case of young people and this the way publicity would effectively prevent them from exercising their rights?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly a intuitive appeal to this line of thought about it. I think it just as easily fits into, again, the colloquial privacy framework as it does a threat framework. The idea is that the law has seen fit with the judicial consent for a minor to allow the minor to make that decision, and it's a private decision. And so one still need not, I think, have to draw what a court might see as a somewhat tenuous line to will it actually amount to a threat from these particular parents? Perversely, you can imagine calling the parents to testify as to whether they, if they knew that the kid, et cetera, et cetera. But to really vest it as privacy. This is a fact about myself that maybe you can glean thanks to the fact that I have to be in public momentarily in order to get to this private space to have this consultation or undergo this procedure. But this should be allowed to rest privately with me. There's no overriding public interest in knowing exactly who I am that I'm going in. And I think that may be a more kind of conservative approach to achieve the result of demonstrating to a court that there's a real interest at stake here. Again, though, as Juliet was pointing out, an organization like the ACLU, a straight civil libertarian approach, has a problem because it's easy to say that the state has no business divulging my name to the parents, perhaps, or otherwise interfering with my right to an abortion as established so carefully in Roe v. Wade. But it's another to say third parties can't stand in a public street and take down names. That's what keeps the ACLU up at night trying to figure out where they stand.
Jamie also raises the issue of privacy versus free speech. Now, we know that free speech is in the Constitution, but as I remember it, Justice Douglas spoke of privacy. He said it is a penumbra based on an emanation. Am I right in that? From the Constitution?
Penumbras and emanations from a combination of the Ninth, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments is what got the Roe v. Wade court where it was, coming off of another case having to do with whether a state can prescribe birth control, Griswold v. Connecticut. And it's couched as a privacy right, but it's hard to think of privacy in that sense. It's really a term of art. It's not the colloquial meaning of privacy. Mm-hmm. It really means to be free of government interference as you make very personal decisions about procreative issues in your own home. And that's different from the kind of privacy that we imagine that when we pull the shade down, we don't expect somebody, you know, the paparazzi, to be able to look in.
Or Neil to show up and take a picture of you.
Jamie, thank you. Steve is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling from a cell phone, and it occurs to me, listening to this Mr. Horsley or whatever his name was, that there's a striking similarity to any kind of hate crime that occurs, particularly, for example, the young gay man who was killed in Texas only because he was gay. How is this not similar to that when women are being targeted as well as doctors who perform abortions? Why is this not considered a hate crime?
Jonathan Zittrain?
Put briefly, to have a hate crime, you need both a hate and the crime. And you have an underlying crime, like beating someone up or killing them or otherwise, you know, just textbook black letter hurting them. And then it might be enhanced, the penalty, if it's motivated by hate or if you say certain things while it's happening. It's adjunct to already having crossed the line by something other than your speech. And here, I think they're very carefully trying to walk whatever lines they think exist to say, hey, I'm not hurting anyone. I'm merely stating facts. And that's why this doesn't so neatly fit into the hate crime category as the example you cited.
Right. I mean, the federal hate crime also is quite limited and does not cover gender. There's been a big debate about that.
It does not cover gender.
Does not cover gender. So you would assume that if there was a hate crime cause of action, it does not cover women. It was written during the civil rights period for, you know, obvious reasons that there was violence against people based on their race or national origin. Several states, actually probably more than several now, do have specific state hate crime statutes that deal with, you know, violence towards women. And if you imagine the caller sort of, you know, as you think this through, well, maybe because they're women getting abortions, that this is violence against women. But it's a pretty far stretch at this stage. I mean, even the case law on the state side is, I mean, you have to be, it's a very difficult thing to prove that you hit someone because they were a woman as compared to because it was your wife and you were mad at her.
Mm-hmm. And yet we know that misogyny and these things exist.
Right.
So it's we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the collision between privacy rights and free speech posed by the digital age and specifically by websites that run photographs of women who entering abortion clinics. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the collision between privacy and free speech posed by internet websites that put photographs of women entering abortion clinics on the web. We're talking with Jonathan Zittrain, he's an assistant professor of law at Harvard, and with Judith Kiam, head of the domestic preparedness program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Joe is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I guess it was Jamie talked about, you know, if parents found out about, saw a girl's picture on the internet, it could cause her some harm. And, I guess the question I was going to ask, let's say I'm out with a mistress and I'm at the county fair and someone takes a photograph and puts it in the newspaper and my wife sees it. Well, that could cause me some harm.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I could get kicked out of the house or she might send me back to the old country. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, don't we get to a point there where, you know, that argument, it was kind of, I thought, a little out of line.
In other words, the argument that a young woman could be sent back to the old country, an immigrant, if her parents knew that
well,
she.
Well, I mean, she said a number of things. She could get in trouble or not get paid, you know, college.
And you didn't see this as really that serious.
I'm not saying it's not serious,
sure.
But as far as when we get to the privacy versus free speech deal, you know, I could get in trouble or, you know, for being out with a girlfriend when my wife sees it and that picture gets taken. I mean, oh, I'm going to sue the newspaper because, you know, this picture caused me to get a divorce, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do see what you mean. How about Joe's point here, Jonathan?
Of course, Joe, your case is a little bit sort of easy to go with because it sounds like serendipity. The newspaper just happened to have a beautiful spring day at the park and, you know, just in front of the cotton candy stand, there's you with your mistress and, you know, how could the newspaper know? If the newspaper had a regular feature in which it sought to out people that were having affairs and actually hired a squad of private investigators to hang around motels and just catch people that they thought were in the act, that's a slightly tougher case. Now, it may turn out, one could imagine, it's not as if this has ever happened, so we don't know. One could imagine, I think, a court ready to find that's intentional infliction of emotional distress, that kind of thing. It's not in the public interest necessarily, and would probably draw a line of just the sort Juliet was talking about earlier in the Hustler v. Falwell case, in which Jerry Falwell said, and a jury in Virginia agreed with him, boy, was I distressed when I opened up Hustler. I guess he was a subscriber. And look what I saw. And there ultimately the Supreme Court said, well, you're a public figure. So maybe you have to open yourself up to ridicule as much as to, the other things that come with that, exactly the baggage that even Neil Horsley was willing to embrace. Whether you have to embrace that baggage as somebody just walking through the park with your mistress may not be as clear. And part of what I think this poses is an internet question apart from anything else is, are we all at some point prepared to have to be as if public figures, to find that if one person in the world takes enough interest in us to act like paparazzi vis-a-vis us, even though we're not all that famous, do we have to endure it the way Madonna does or someone else?
Oh, what's the answer to that?
For that, we need more time and we need...
For her money, I'd endure it, too.
So that can happen. Someone can just conceive a dislike for you or an obsession and photograph you endlessly and put you on
the... Well,
rail.
Again, this is where if they put me on the Wheaties box, I've got them. If they're making money off me, they make a T-shirt out of me or something, no problem. And the First Amendment is not going to be all that big a deal. So the question will be how to articulate this area of law where, for the first time, really, you have an obscure enough interest in somebody in another person that is not a public figure and not even a financial interest that could amount to great distress on the part of that figure. There's a couple websites out there. Smalltownjustice.com is one I use in my internet class a lot. That's a woman who got pulled over by the California Highway Patrol and decided to make a website about the whole thing. It's generated 3 lawsuits so far from what I can tell. And it includes information about the officer who pulled her over, the lawyer who represented the officer, and his libel suit against her. And you just watch the whole thing unfold like the real world.
The internet is opening up all kinds of free speech questions and privacy questions. Phil is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello, welcome.
Hi. I think it's rather interesting. I mean, in an absolute sense, you know, free speech is free speech. So fine, he, I suppose, in that sense, has the right to do what he's doing. But, I mean, look, I think this really is a red herring in a way because they are admitting, Horsley and company, defeat. I mean, basically, they've lost the argument because aside from that small group that supports what they're doing, they're not getting through to anyone else. And by going along this course and making it a free speech thing, I mean, it just seems so counterproductive and it's an act of desperation. I mean, in a free speech sense, fine, yeah, free speech is free speech. They'll do it. They can do it. But in terms of the actual argument, the original thing this is all about, they've lost it because it's only that bunch of zealots and fanatics that are on his side that would support this kind of action. If this is all he has to resort to, then that means in terms of the actual argument itself, in terms of abortion, he's lost it, right?
Well, but doesn't abortion rights just basically depend on who's appointed to the Supreme Court next? I mean, isn't there just one vote that could take it away?
What you have here is an appeal to the public at large, right? He's trying to go beyond that group that he's a part of that supports this kind of extreme action that he's taken. I think he's lost it, and he's therefore appealing to free speech, which is just a red herring, really.
Okay. Phil has a point to the extent that the internet is interesting in the regard that it's both public and sort of not public, because you got to do some searching to find where you want to go. So it's not like I go on my AOL account and all of a sudden Neil's the anti-abortion website is online, that it takes an affirmative effort to actually find this information. And, I mean, to that extent, it's not like, you know, the guy standing on the corner passing out pamphlets to anyone who passes by. Or, I mean, it's mm-hmm. a much more, it's less passive than before, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. It certainly may be that as an attempt to persuade people that are less decided than he about the merits of the issue, you know, he puts it as we want to document what's going on. As a rhetorical exercise, it might be an utter mm-hmm. failure. I mean, it's not going to persuade one person who isn't already in his camp. But one senses that the other purpose of it is just to affect one person at a time trying to go in. And if enough of a circus can be created outside the clinic where the consultation is needed or somebody needs to go in to obtain an abortion, that might divert somebody and change their mind. Mm. And one senses that's what he's out to do, at least as much as change the sure. minds of those who don't agree with him.
Sure. Thank you, Phil. Mohammed is on the line. Hello.
Hi, Jack. How you doing?
All right. If you can be brief, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I just want to talk about the professor has brought up a point of, you know, that they could take a picture of that lady and put it on a cereal box, and then that, you know, the General Mills could be making money off that.
Sure.
They could not, even if they do that, they could not, the lady could not, you know, claim, she cannot seek, you know, legal action based on the appropriation tort, because she's not a public person. She's a private person. I mean, who knows this lady other than people who are close to this area, like, what's his name, the guy who put up this website? But the rest of us, like the yeah. general public, a guy like myself who drives cab in Boston does not know the lady. So, therefore, she could not seek legal action. But there are things where she can, where she got a case, and that is, she could seek the different tort of law, where she can claim that
her privacy is.
That her privacy was violated.
Yeah. What about this, Jonathan Zittrin?
Well, it's all one big mix. I mean, the appropriation tort is a facet of the overall privacy framework.
The appropriation tort means taking my image and appropriating
my likeness.
My likeness.
Even unfamous, unattractive people can have their likenesses misappropriated, because that might have been their big break. If it was somehow in General Mills' interest to put Joe Everyman, the taxi driver, onto their box, you know, well, maybe I'm due my due for it. Again, that would be just right in the core of what the law already well recognizes. But to be sure, when we talk about appropriation of likeness, this is mostly developed in California, because Hollywood is the epicenter of it.
Of course. People's image is how they earn their. Right. Well, you know, you both convinced me that we're going to have these questions not only in this realm, but again and again and again raised by this peculiar or unique form of communication, the Internet, which is, as you say, not passive. But it's ubiquitous. It's not just a man standing on the street corner.
Right, exactly.
It's everywhere.
Well, the Internet has taken down a lot of barriers, and the question is the law of a frame to want to put some of them at least back up?
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan Zittrin. He's an assistant professor of law and co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And thank you, Judith Kayyem.
Thank
She's
you.
Head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Continue the conversation online at our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, War and Peace through an artist's brush. This is On Point. Canadian artist Derek Houston has worked throughout his career to incorporate society's deepest issues into his paintings. Houston's work is sometimes celebratory, sometimes critical. In several paintings, he protests the international sanctions against Iraq, while other pieces honor the spirit of Sarajevan cellist Vladimir Vandrasmolovic, who played as bombs fell. In his latest project, Derek Houston is creating what he hopes will be the world's largest peace sanctuary. In this radio diary, he tells us how the idea was born.
Hi, I came to build this peace sanctuary over a long process. It actually started from my interest in war, and a lot of my paintings also deal with things about life. And so after the Gulf War, I started to hear stories about the number of children that were dying as a result of the sanctions that were placed on that country. So I couldn't help but become involved and tried to do something that would draw the world's attention towards this. I started by doing a lot of very angry kind of paintings, but I found that I needed to find something with a sort of a gentler way of persuading people. I came up with the idea of doing something in a hayfield, but the problem with that was that it wasn't permanent. Essentially, it was all just baled up at the end of the day. So then I thought, well, I've got to try and do something more permanent, something that as it grows, the idea grows. This peace sanctuary for children is going to be up in near Hudson Hope, which is in the northeast corner of British Columbia, Canada. It's in a wilderness setting on an abandoned gravel pit. What I will be doing is moving this gravel into the shape of this image. And what I'm trying to create is something that looks very primitive, very prehistoric. It'll be a drawing of a mother and child, kind of the mother's hand just kind of protecting the child and a dove. And all of that central image has got radiating ripples, almost like ripples from a pond radiating out across the landscape. It'll be completely made of gravel. The mounds will be about 8 feet to 9 feet high, 15 feet across the base, and the entire width of this thing is going to be about 1,500 feet. Stonehenge is about 300 feet to the outer ditches, so that gives you some idea of the scale. What I'm hoping that if people go there and to visit this thing, I want them to feel a sense of shelter. I want them to feel protected, some kind of spiritual communion with the earth. I want them to be inspired. I want them to feel a certain order, that there is a place, a sanctuary that you can go to and think about peace issues and things. I want people to feel loved. I want them to have compassion. I want them to feel as if they're visiting a simple church and experience that same kind of spiritual feeling when you go inside and have that kind of rest. It'll be a place that you'll have to journey to. It's not going to be necessarily an easy place to get to. You're going to have to decide that you're going to go up there and make a commitment of a weekend to go up and see this thing. And think about what's going on in the world and how we can communicate better. About 5 years from now, I'm hoping that people will hear about this thing through word of mouth. I know that people will hear about it through different magazine articles. And so 5 years from now, people will journey to this thing, make a special little weekend out of it, bring their companion, bring their children, bring their instrument. I really want to see musicians go up there, like a cellist go up and bring their cello and just sit at the viewpoint here and just play their cello out there in the middle of this wilderness setting. I really want to see music a big part of this thing. But I'm hoping other artists will hear about this thing through all these different kind of mediums. And I'm hoping one of the big central ideas behind this whole idea is to get other artists to do a similar type project, a mother and child themed thing. And so these things will be springing up in different parts of the world.
Derek Houston plans to break ground on his peace sanctuary on June 13th. For more information on Derek Houston's art and the peace sanctuary, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WB.